I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The former president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, and Frank's stepsister, George Clooney, have made comparisons between Donald Trump and fascist leaders in this world in World War II, Hitler and Mussolini. So we thought it would be interesting to do a show on fascism and see if there's any validity to those claims. Our guest this hour says, beyond Hitler and Mussolini, fascism can be hard to define. When he looks at Donald Trump, he sees similarities and differences to Trump and Mussolini. We'll talk about where the messages are the same and where the messages are different, and what about the persona. Our guest is Professor Robert Paxton. He's Professor Emeritus of Social Sciences at Columbia University. He specializes in the social and political history of modern Europe, particularly Vichy France during World War II. He was the first in the 60s and 70s to establish, on the basis of German archives, the active collaboration of Vichy France within Hitler's Europe. He is the author of many books, including The Anatomy of Fascism. He is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. We'll be welcoming phone calls about how Donald Trump is and is not a fascist. During the course of this hour, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Robert Paxton, thank you very much for being with us.
And thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Can you talk about historically what was going on in Germany, what was going on in Italy that made those countries ripe for fascist leaders? And if you see any kind of historical comparison when it comes to the economy, when it comes to other factors between those eras in history and the U.S. in 2016?
Okay, well, what happened with Germany and with Italy during and after the First World War was calamity. Germany lost the war. Germany lost the war in a humiliating way and was subjected to foreign occupation. Italy was on the winning side, but they had broad ambitions for expansion, which were frustrated at the peace conference, and Italy was on the verge of revolution at the end of the war, and the war had been extremely polarizing. The Socialist Party had opposed it, and there was a lot of internal conflict, and Italy was virtually starting out toward a Bolshevik revolution. And at that point, in 1918-19, a lot of people thought that the Russian Revolution was just a start, that the thing was going to march west, and there were Bolshevik revolutions in Germany as well. So these countries, Germany in particular, defeat the threat of a communist revolution in 1923, a disastrous inflation, which meant that everybody who had money in the bank, basically the middle class, were wiped out. And then in 1929, the Great Depression that started in America reached Germany.
And it was almost as bad in Germany, you've said, as it was in this country, right?
Well, in some ways worse. I mean, the huge unemployment, just utterly massive unemployment, and basically it means that the government you have simply can't face can't deal with it. Indeed, Germany's parliamentary government was new. Germany had been an empire until 1918. Parliamentary democracy was set up and had to deal with these excessive crises not terribly well. It had to sign the peace treaty, which meant that it started off looking humiliated, and in 1930 it simply ceased to function. You couldn't put a majority together because they couldn't choose between more taxes or more unemployment benefits. Sounds kind of familiar, but it was no longer possible to put together a majority. So after 1930, German governments were more or less run by the powers of the president, the emergency powers of the president, and they were desperate to find something else.
When you talk about, when Donald Trump talks about his message about making America great again, portraying America as being in decline, and he's going to make us prosperous and healthy again, you remind us that at this point in our history, we were in really bad shape when President Obama took over, close to a depression in this country. But things have gotten better, maybe not for everybody. How does that theme work for Donald Trump? Because things aren't as bad as they were in 2008, are they?
Oh, no. Things for a great many Americans, we've had a recovery, a remarkable recovery, so that the United States has the strongest economy in the world and has the strongest military in the world, and it seems a little odd to be saying that that we're in decline. But the trouble was that the recovery was uneven. The stock market has gone way up since 2008. Employment has gone way up since 2008, but there are pockets of people who were left behind, and these weren't just random. There's a characteristic about these people. They're mostly in the Rust Belt areas or traditional areas of mining or metal bashing industry, like Appalachia for coal mines, Middle West for automobile industry, textile industry, and so forth, and people who have traditionally been able to make a very good living doing traditional metal bashing weren't able to get jobs because a lot of the old industrial jobs had been outsourced, but an even greater number of them were also simply being taken over by automation and robots. So it isn't just foreign competition. But nevertheless, a great many people couldn't get jobs, and basically they were the people who weren't very well educated because they weren't able to do handle the sophisticated digital equipment that was now necessary to be a modern industry. Their skills were no longer relevant, and they tended to be white, they tended to be male, mm-hmm. and they tended to be in traditionally poor zones like Appalachia, and they were suspicious of trendy modern things like gay rights and feminism, and all those things seem to them to be ganging up on the good old-fashioned American country people that they were.
Mm-hmm. And didn't like foreigners, didn't like Muslims, certainly didn't like Mexicans. So you have talked about the ethnic stereotypes that Donald Trump gives in some abundance and this fear of foreigners, particularly Muslim foreigners. You have, I've heard you quoted as saying it's directly out of a fascist recipe book.
Well, it certainly sounds like the sorts of things that Hitler and Mussolini were talking about. In our own case, it's easy to blame all of unemployment on foreigners, on immigrants taking the jobs. But of course, that's not far from the only reason. There's automation and other things. But the language of decline was the absolute center of the fascist line in Italy in 1922 and in Germany in the late 1920s. Our country has been wrecked by leftists, by foreigners, by Jews. Each country has its own special enemy that things get attributed to, and this idea that the country is headed down headed into deep decline unless the great leader who is at hand is allowed to step in and do what he wants without being controlled by legal niceties.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Donald Trump was doing, Dr. Paxton, with the whole birther movement?
I found that extremely baffling. Of course, that came well before he declared himself a candidate. So it's hard to relate it to his candidacy. I don't know what he was doing. I think it's very bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
He's very stubborn. He gets onto a point like that and doesn't want to let it go. And I don't see what the advantage was to him at that point.
I'm wondering, when we look at the number of people in this country who may have been offended, if that's the right word to use here, by having an African-American president, and how he may play to that crowd in his presidential run, and if indeed he was sort of building up to that when he started that whole movement.
Well, that's a logical explanation, and I think that sounds very, very plausible. If in fact, at that time, he was really laying the groundwork and not just spouting off, then indeed that was an important thing to do. We're going back really to the election of 2012 already, and Trump's thinking might already have been pointing that far into today, but he was not the only person to Fox News went on with this idea for a very long time. I suppose Trump went on with it longer than anyone else.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about Trump as being an impulsive person. I think you said in an interview, Trump is a skilled opportunist, but also less conscious politically than Hitler and Mussolini. How so?
Well, I've been taken to task for that. Someone has sent me references to a bedside book of Hitler's speeches that he was thought to have had, but that was hearsay testimony. And it's as I listen to Donald Trump and watch him, I think he's a man who takes his own counsel. I don't think he's following a model. I believe he's being himself. I don't get the impression that he sat down in a book and learned what it was like to talk like Mussolini and jot out his jaw like Mussolini and so forth in 1922, modeled himself on it. Seems to me those things are a direct expression of the kind of personality he is. He's proud of his talents. He wants to push himself forward. He doesn't like contradiction or opposition, and those qualities simply come forth naturally without having been learned in a book. He doesn't strike me as someone who takes lessons from a book.
Mm-hmm. And what about how Mussolini and Hitler were very accomplished politicians?
Well, they were very skillful because they thought at the very beginning they thought they were doing one thing, and then when that became impossible, they adjusted and did another. Mussolini found himself as a wounded war veteran in 1918, absolutely alone. Because his own political home was the Italian Socialist Party. He'd been quite a senior figure in the Italian Socialist Party before the war. He'd been the editor of his newspaper. He was a notable figure. But he was always a bit of a maverick, and he came to believe that war is the most revolutionary thing that people can do. And so he wanted Italy, which had remained neutral, to come into the war on the Allied side, and that this would dynamize Italy. It would give Italy a shot in the arm, and Italy would become a great power. And the socialists who were pacifists threw him out of the party. So Mussolini was alone, without friends, without supporters in 1918. And he decided he would put himself at the head of the veterans movement. And he formed the first fascio. The fascio was a group of committed people who promised to work together, a little band of brothers. He founded the first fascio in the spring of 1919 with a very radical program. He wanted to vote for women. He wanted to seize the land of the church. He was open to the question of getting rid of the monarchy. And he got exactly nowhere in the elections of 1919. So he found a new way to go, which was that at that very moment, the organized left, the labor movement, was organizing the peasants in the Po Valley and the landowners were trying to fight them off with their own sons and neighbors and so forth. And Mussolini's black shirts offered to come and help. And they suddenly found themselves famous and powerful as the force that stopped the unionization of farm workers in the Po Valley. And there they were virtually in charge of a number of important towns like Bologna in the northeast of Italy. And so suddenly here's a rather different recipe that's worked, so Mussolini took it. That's what I mean when he's opportunist. Hitler, similarly, his first program was his 21 points in 1920. It was quite radical. And then when he needed allies in the army and in the civil service and so forth, he toned it down. So they were skilled enough to see where openings were and were able to exploit those openings.
Mm-hmm. I think you've written there are ways in which Trump differs from the fascists. They wanted to regiment everybody, and they wanted to have a strong state, whereas nobody in the Republican Party wants anything but less regulation. So I don't think the label works terribly well, and I'm not a great fan, you say, of these labels anyway. Can you talk about individualism a little bit and how individualism is a hallmark of the Republican Party? Is it also of Donald Trump's philosophy, what we know about it, and how it was disdained in Germany particularly?
Well, in Europe at the time of the First World War and the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, 1914 to 1917 to 1918, that individualism was sort of at the heart of parliamentary democracy and liberal regimes where people had free speech and you had free elections. And then the First World War came along, which was a turmoil that demanded every last ounce of energy and every last bit of organizational strength out of the countries that were in it, and many of them simply came apart, like Russia and the Habsburg Empire, Austria-Hungary. They just couldn't stand the strain. And so you came out of the war with the notion that an individualistic free society might not be strong enough to deal with something as calamitous as the war. And fascism was an outright assault on individualism. It led to societies that were weak and flabby and had no spinal cord. It led to divisions because you had differences of opinion in the parliament, elections. Let every known opinion express itself, and so they were useless. In industry, you had a conflict between workers and managers, each one's seeking their particular interest. And these countries were weakened by individualism. So the thing to do was to find a way to rally everybody around an appeal in which they could subordinate their individuals to a grander vision of the community, of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Nationalism is supposed to overcome these weaknesses. And so you have something relatively new, not completely new. The Garibaldi had his red shirts and so forth, but you put young people in shirts and you march them up and down and you go through all these rituals in which individuals raise their arms and swear that they will put the community first and their own desires second, and so there was this coercion that runs through these societies. This comes from the ground up. There's lots of testimony that the young people loved it. They found this enormously attractive. They compared it to their rather slack bourgeois parents, and they found the excitements of the Hitler Youth and the German girls' movement was very thrilling to them. And so you have something greater to live for, and your individualism is disciplined by this national cause. And Italy, very similarly, with a little bit less success than Germany, because Italy is a more variegated country, and the administration was a little sloppier. But they even regimented sports in Italy. There was a national sports organization that if you wanted to play tennis, you did it through the fascist sports organization. And it's an astonishing degree of regimentation in the name of giving our country some discipline, pulling them together, getting them to recognize the common interest. I can't imagine a language more contrary to the way the U.S. has been since the 60s, when the slogan, if it feels good, do it, seems to have spread to the right and the conservatives as well. And the Tea Party, a movement which we hear much less about because I guess it's been sort of soaked up by Donald Trump. But the idea is that we shouldn't be letting governments tell us what to do, and particularly if you're a businessman who's creating jobs, there shouldn't be bureaucrats picking on you and making you put ventilation in the mine shafts and so forth. You're there to provide jobs and make a profit.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Robert Paxton, professor emeritus of social sciences at Columbia University. His special areas are the social and political history of modern Europe, particularly Vichy France during World War II. He is the author of all kinds of books, including The Anatomy of Fascism. We're talking about fascism this hour of the program. There have been people who have defined Donald Trump as fascists, and we found a lot of different articles that looked at Donald Trump and tried to make comparisons between Hitler and Mussolini and Trump. Are there similarities? Are there differences? What are they? How is Donald Trump a fascist? How is he not a fascist? And we're welcoming phone calls for Dr. Paxton. Our phone number, a couple lines are open for you right now. We're going to go to your phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Professor Paxton, 800-486-8655. Harry in Madison is our first caller. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Dr. Paxton.
Hello.
What evidence is there in the literature that the bizarre self-centeredness of these men like Franco, Hitler, and Mussolini is based in a narcissistic personality disorder?
Well, it's very difficult to psychoanalyze somebody who isn't here, and all the more so somebody who is dead. And so I tread very warily here. Both men had a really unnatural degree of self-assurance. They were certain that they were right, and they didn't accept opposition lightly. And in the case of Hitler, this was so all-consuming that he went right to the end and right to his own suicide, disregarding the advice of his own generals and high civil servants at a number of points along the way. I'm not a psychiatrist, not a psychologist, and I'm not trained to give a learned diagnosis, but that's certainly what it looks like.
Hmm. Thanks, Harry, for the call. David writes on Facebook, people should look a bit further back at a different country. Our situation is closer to the Russian Empire in the 1890s, a country with a slowly collapsing economy, enormous divides between the rich and poor, oblivious ruling elite, and numerous social fault lines and an overstretched military. If anything, we are headed, David believes, towards something closer to the Russian Revolution than fascism.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that the condition of Russia on the eve of World War I was a great deal more grave and troubling than the situation in the United States today. Russia had a huge industrial growth. It was concentrated in a few great cities like St. Petersburg, and in the Donbass ore basin, for example, which is now in Ukraine, and in those great cities there was an extremely powerful working class organized for the most part around Marxist principles by communists, by various kinds of socialists. The organized left in Russia was extremely powerful. The organized left in the United States, first of all, has almost no communists left. The Social Democrats still run a few labor movements, but the labor organizations mobilize only about 10 or 12, maybe 15% of our working class, and even less than that. So the political polarization is considerably less. So our situation, I think, is not nearly as dire as that. But before the First World War, let's say, when it got really bad in a country and there were a lot of people who felt disfranchised and discriminated against and hopeless, They mobilized to the left. They mobilized to the growing new socialist and social democratic and eventually communist parties. And after the successful Russian Revolution in 1917, the left was also a very powerful magnet for all kinds of protest voting. Since 1991, with the disappearance of the Soviet Union as an organized entity and the collapse of communist parties everywhere, except for a small remnant, the protest voting tends to go to nationalist anti-immigrant movements on the right. Now, those are the parties that soak up the voters that are bored by middle-class parties and want something more exciting and then want something that looks like it's working for revolutionary change. But these things tend to be on the right. The left as a home for the angry protest voter has pretty much stopped. So the right is where the action is in all the European countries, the National Front in France, the People's Freedom Party in Austria that almost won the presidency, even in Scandinavia and in Holland. There are these would-be authoritarian, anti-immigrant, nativist parties, and so that seems to be a rather new makeup. And I don't think we are that much like Russia in 1913.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Sarah in Lake Zurich. Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, sir.
Okay, thank you very much for having the professor. I have to take a deep breath because I'm so worried about him. And also, I want to disagree with you about the regulation thing because I think that Republicans like regulations really well if it's about social issues. And now we're seeing a lot of Republican legislatures and states forbid communities from passing local control ordinances. Okay. Two, that pledge that Donald Trump had people take where they raise their hand in the air, I don't think Trump could possibly not be aware that that's going to look like a Hitler salute. And I don't know if that's why, I don't know, I'm not saying that he wants to be Hitler, but I think he certainly knew it would attract people to him. Three, the way that fascists regard women, I think totally is in line with how Trump has talked about women, like in Franco and Mussolini and the Hitler regimes. Four, I hear rhetoric from Trump about how we need a strong police force, how we're going to stop protesters from disrespecting the police, how he's not going to let protesters get away with stuff like that, and how the press is full of, you know, the press is just bad, and he's... I think that when he becomes president, he will suspend habeas corpus, quite possibly, and start throwing people in jail.
Thanks, Sarah, for your call.
Yes. Those are extremely interesting observations, and I think you're quite right about the issue of regulation. It's not nearly as clear as I wanted to make it. Regulation, everybody wants to put some degree of regulation to work in their own interest. And so Republicans are, for example, trying to regulate the voting process more closely, requiring photo IDs because they are convinced that there's fraud in the elections, and so there are regulations about how you dispose of the American flag, and it makes it illegal to burn it. Everybody uses regulation, but the insistent cries against regulation were coming from the Tea Party not so long ago, and there's very definitely a move away from environmental.
Yes,
this was called the Sagebrush Rebellion. When Ronald Reagan was elected president, with the support of Western ranchers and Western timbermen and miners, there's a real grassroots movement, particularly in the West, against rules that limit how many cattle you can graze or how much timber you can take out. There's, I think, a strong groundswell against regulations that businessmen feel make it impossible to make a profit. Regulations about worker safety and how you display goods and so forth. That same thing in Europe. The EU has all these regulations about how to make pizza and so forth, and people are fed up with them. I think that there's the preponderance is anti-regulation, and that's and that's part of the energy behind this movement. Now, some of these other issues are absolutely on all grounds. The salute, well, my take is that Donald Trump knows, it looks like, the Nazis. He doesn't care. I think he's happy to affront any degree of opposition. I still doubt that he went out and learned that, but he is willing to adopt some things that look a little strange to some of us. Position on women, I should certainly have mentioned it. It's extremely important. The original fascist movements of Mussolini and Hitler were dealing with countries that had been profoundly humiliated, and they tried desperately to restore the war-making virility of their young men, and it was a very, very conscious practice in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany of getting women out of employment and into the home and into active childbearing and so forth. So that's anti-feminism going much, much further than anything that's being mentioned today, but that's definitely a common point. And finally, green light for the police is always another common, common theme. Those are all accurate.
But what about when you talk about his awareness, maybe not having read books about all this, but there's got to be some reason he would retweet Mussolini, isn't there? No, seriously, why would you do that?
I have no idea. It's true that he was taxed with having tweeted a Mussolini quote. Well, then he said, no, I just retweeted it.
Right.
And I don't see that that's very different. And then he said, it's an interesting sentiment. I don't care who voiced it. I mean, I think he really likes to be out there in a daring way and just enjoys it. He knows that he's going to get free publicity. He doesn't have to raise a cent to buy time on television.
Right.
All he needs to do is drop one of these bombs, and he's coast to coast, full time. It's a stroke of genius. I'm certainly saying that he doesn't mind using these things. He doesn't think it's so bad.
Mm. A listener who couldn't stay on the line wanted for you to give us kind of a nutshell definition of fascism in order to better understand what it means, and to those who may not be familiar with the term. Is there a nutshell definition?
Well, I struggled hard with that in my book, The Anatomy of Fascism. Everybody teases me because my nutshell definition is more like a coconut than a peanut. But because there's so much one needs to pack in there. But in the most summary way, fascism is a nationalistic movement that attempts to heal a nation that has been severely damaged by war or by revolution or by depression, damaged and humiliated, and needs to put its act back together again, and not by going back to parliamentary government, because that's been proven for these countries not to have worked. Now, in my book on fascism, I divide it up into five phases, and I'll be very quick about this, because fascism looks rather different. When it's just starting out, it seems very radical. I've already mentioned this about Mussolini and Hitler. They had these, trying to make their first appeals, they had all these appeals to things like the rights of women, which they very soon gave up on. At the very beginning, you have these movements out there that are not very well organized and are sort of feeling their way along. And secondly, if they find an issue where they can really get traction, then they make a place for themselves in the political spectrum, and that was like Mussolini's black shirts helping out the farmers and smashing the agrarian labor movement, and that's I call that the rooting process. It gets rooted and becomes part, begins to be accepted by everybody as a normal part of the political system. Then there's coming to power, and the curious thing there was that the fascists, none of them were ever elected outright. Hitler got 36% of the vote in the latest free election, where he did well. But they were brought into power by the president and the king as a bulwark against communism. Mm. In both countries, communists were coming up very fast. The middle classes were terrified that they were going to have a Bolshevik revolution there, and the fascists and the Nazis looked like they had the secret to stopping by direct physical action, by beating up the communists. So they were brought into the government. Once they were brought into the government, both Hitler and Mussolini shoved the conservatives aside and took over. So they didn't have a revolution to get into power. They had a revolution after power. And so after that, you have the way they govern, which was by setting aside any kind of limit of law, and would do whatever the leader thought was in the best interest of the country. The last stage I had was radicalization, because these people all want to expand their countries. It's one of the things that we don't have today. Nobody wants to expand the United States and take parts of Canada or Mexico, as far as I know. But that was an absolutely indispensable part of Nazism and fascism, to overturn the Versailles Peace Settlement and get back Germany's great frontiers and get Italy, land in Africa and land in Turkey and so forth. And so war, one of Mussolini's favorite quotes was, war is to men as childbearing is to women. It's what men do. And he was very eager to make men out of Italians. And so they all went off to war. Once you get involved in war, then anything goes, and you start murdering your minorities. I mean, you go to the utmost extreme when you're in war. So I examine fascism on the move, so to speak, how it evolved over time, but always nationalistic, forceful, seeking to aggrandize and seeking to get rid of the internal enemy.
Thank you so much for the coconut definition. It was good. We're going to welcome phone calls, more of them. Our lines are quite filled. We're talking about fascism. There have been comparisons made between Donald Trump and fascist leaders, Mussolini and Hitler. Are there valid comparisons here? Our guest is an expert in fascism. Professor Robert Paxton is professor emeritus of social sciences at Columbia University, and he is an expert on the social and political history of modern Europe. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tomorrow during this hour, the Wisconsin Water Summit will get underway next week here in Milwaukee, and we'll be hearing from leading researchers and keynote speakers who are talking about public water supplies tomorrow during this hour. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Tim is next in Racine. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, this is more of an observation than anything on Trump's deeds or words. It's my dad grew up in Nazi Germany, was 14 when the war ended, was in Nazi Hitler Youth and all that. And we never talked about politics as a kid. And as he's gotten older, he's gotten more and more into it, and also very conservative. And he just loves Trump. I'm on the left, and I just can't even talk to him about it anymore.
Oh dear.
And so I'm thinking that maybe there is something to it. Maybe there's something about Trump that strikes a chord with people who would be Nazis or right-wingers.
He's had the support already of Mr. Duke, the head of the Klan, and so forth. And so there's definitely a rapport between Trump and people who believe in socking your enemies in the jaw, who want to not be bothered by the rule of law, to go ahead. Trump's own father, we know nothing about him except he was in New York in the 30s when the German-American Bund was heavily pro-Hitler, but that was before Trump was born, so we unfair to do that. I understand those legacies very, very, very well. I met people like that, too.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to those people. You've said this, and I'm wondering about this. When you talked about the economic recovery and how a lot of people didn't fare very well in that recovery, and maybe politicians in Washington missed that by a long shot this election season, poorly educated white males left behind, there are enough of those people to make a huge difference, you have said, but I don't think there are enough of those people to elect a president. They can make a powerful movement.
Mm-hmm.
Do you stand by that now?
Yeah, I do, definitely. Our choice of candidates is a very, very weird process, and it gives the voice to the most engaged and most militant and indeed often most extreme partisans, either in caucuses or simply because they're more motivated to vote in primary elections. And so at the primary stage, these people get to show all their strength. And then at the regular election stage, the candidates have to appeal to the moderates in the center, the people who may not necessarily have taken a large part in the nomination process. And so things tend to be, there tends to be a move toward the center. Trump doesn't seem to be doing that. He's always followed his own drummer. I think it's quite interesting not to see this not happening. But there are the very, very noisy groups that have dominated the primary process in the Republican Party are like a half of a half. They're part of the Republican Party, which is part of the United States, and as an absolute number of citizens, I don't think they can elect a president. Mm-hmm. If Trump succeeds in getting a lot of ordinary middle-of-the-road moderate people, or if Hillary Clinton really isn't able to galvanize her people, then he could be elected.
It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's just amazing.
Yes. Well, by considering where we were 2 years ago when Trump was going out to nightclubs and being generally thought of as a little bit humorous.
Right. It's hard to think of him as humorous. I mean, he's not a very humorous guy, is he?
Well, maybe ridiculous is the
word. Right. Yeah.
But we started on labels, and I think one of the troubles with a label like fascism is such an electric label that it hides us from what some of the things that are really going on, and what I think is really worrisome in the United States is the loss of a sense of common interest.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Republicans in general and Trump in particular are really not fascist, because they do not try to discipline everybody in the name of some kind of common interest. It's everyone for himself.
Let's go to Tom in Appleton next. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi again. Part of my understanding of fascism has always been that it contains within an unholy and unwarranted alliance between government and capital, industry, and so on, the Krupps in Germany and so on.
Yes.
And as such, and if I'm right about that, I see that as part and parcel of the Republican Party, period, and probably nowhere better represented than right here in the state of Wisconsin, where we've got an administration and a legislature that, just to cite one of numerous examples, thought we should have the world's largest open-pit iron mine at the headwaters of 35 Class A trout streams against the vociferous protests of the citizens of the state. And as such, I don't see it as a big leap. And maybe this guy is just a more mixed-up version of that, because I don't think he knows quite where he's at yet. I think it's the egotism and so on running the show more than anything. But I wonder what you would think about that.
Yes, well, that's for a very, very long time been a major interpretation of fascism. It was the businessmen that got together and invented Mussolini and Hitler in order to get the labor movement into line. The professional historians who know how to mess up a good story have put a dent into that. A friend of mine actually went through German business records painstakingly and proved that the German industrialists gave money to all the non-socialist parties. They wouldn't give any money to the socialists. They gave some money to the Nazis, and you can't stop there. They gave even more money to the centrist parties, the Nationalist Party, the Center Party, the Democratic Party, and so forth. And the person they really wanted in 1932 was an aristocrat named von Papen, and because they thought Hitler was surrounded by a bunch of economic crazies, which he was. So they were not so thrilled by Hitler out of power, but once Hitler was named chancellor on the 30th of January 1933, they came around magnificently, and there were these meetings in the spring of 33 where Hitler promised to reward them richly with with rearmament contracts, and they promised to give up their evil ways of trading and accept autarky and do everything for the rearmament of Germany. And they were thrilled with the dissolution of trade unions and the making strikes illegal, and so there was a very, very close cooperation after Hitler got into power. I don't think Hitler invented it. I don't think the businessman invented him. It really came out of German society, and that would be too easy if something that the businessmen had cooked up. But definitely, once Hitler was in power, and same with Mussolini, they had a very, very close and very fruitful working relationship. Mm.
Thank you so much, Tom, for your call. Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I find your show, again, as always, incredibly interesting and thought-provoking. I wanted to ask your guest about President Obama's executive orders. Isn't that, in a sense, a prelude to fascism and using the executive orders to circumvent the democratic process that we've already had in the United States? We've also had political attacks through the government, through Lois Lerner and the IRS, as well as a lack of freedom of information, as we see with Hillary Clinton and her emails. It's on both sides, and we need to stop that to promote our democracy. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Okay, I just to reply, I think that when President Obama issues an executive order, it's within the context of a legislative framework that's already been put together by Congress, and both parties do this, it's acting within the law. Whereas what's really bad is when an executive acts outside the law, and that's what we can't tolerate.
Can you think of any people who we could call fascists in American history, recent American history?
Oh, yes. I think that we've had true fascists. I mean, we've had extreme anti-immigrant and anti-foreign nativist instincts. So right in the very beginning, the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798, the Know-Nothings in the 1840s, the very negative reactions to the arrival of Catholic immigrants, mainly Irish, in the middle of the 19th century, and then there's a whole host of direct action groups. Direct action groups being one of the hallmarks of fascism. These thugs, which may or may not wear shirts, I gather some of the southern anti-black groups wore red shirts, and would attack blacks who were getting uppity and put them back in their place. The white citizens supremacist organizations are very clearly sort of self-help groups that are designed to put down the eternal enemy, an internal enemy, and get the state back in order. And then, of course, there are the direct copiers, particularly 1930s, George Lincoln Rockwell, American Nazi Party, Father Coughlin on the radio out of Detroit, saying that Hitler was on the right road. So they've always remained in the margins. We've been fortunate to have political leaders who were strong enough and successful enough to keep these things in the margin. It's when the regular politicians fail lamentably that the people on the margins begin to move into view.
Hmm. One more call. We have about a minute left. Willie in Madison. Hi.
I'll try to keep it quick. I frequented a restaurant in Madison in the 70s and 80s owned by an old man who had been in the Italian army in the same platoon with Mussolini and with Angelo Roncalli, actually, too, who later became the Pope. When I see Trump being interviewed, I am always reminded of what my friend Alberto said about how it was to talk to and argue with Mussolini. Mussolini knew everything. He rejected many questions. He never would concede a point about anything, is what the man said. And, it was quite an interesting thing, I thought, to meet somebody who had personally known Mussolini.
That sounds right. And the point made by an earlier telephoner about the narcissistic personality, and I think that's a part of it.
Yeah. Thank you, Willie, so much
for
your call. Thanks for your call. Dr. Paxton, thank you so much for being with us. It was a really interesting hour.
Good. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Our guest this hour, Professor Robert Paxton, Professor Emeritus at Columbia University. He's a very prominent scholar of fascism, previously served as the chair of Columbia's history department, and he wrote a book, The Anatomy of Fascism, in 2004. It's been published in 12 languages. He specializes in the social and political history of modern Europe, particularly Vichy France during the World War II era, and has received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Historical Association. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. A reminder that tonight NPR has special programming, 6 primaries and caucuses going on tonight, so that should be from 7 p.m. until midnight. Tomorrow, during the first hour of our show, Walter Kern, an award-winning writer who wrote a piece in Harper's that this election proves how disenfranchised many Americans feel by mainstream political parties. So that's the first hour of our program tomorrow. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for all of your telephone calls.